Hello.
Hello.
Hi, John.
I'm worried I'm going to be a little long-winded today. Because this is a topic that's very dear to my heart,
yes.
Because I feel like it's an aspect of the practice that I personally have neglected, and I feel like I'm paying the price for it. And so for several months now, I've been sort of looking at the topic and gathering information and learning all I can about it and trying to get some clarity for myself so that I can then also present it to you as clearly as I can, but also hoping that it will motivate me to really try and incorporate this more into my practice, help me deepen my practice as a result. Because it is, you know, it's part of the Eightfold Path. It's in that second practice of right intention. Everyone basically familiar with the eight practices, the eight factors of the Eightfold Path? Would it be useful to just sort of, Jean's saying, go ahead. All right, so the Noble Eightfold Path, basically a set of eight practices that lead to awakening, enlightenment, freedom from suffering and discontent. They are right view or right understanding, basically understanding the teachings. And then that's followed by right intention, which we'll talk about today. It's really sort of, well, we're going to talk about it today, so I won't say any more about that. And then the ethical practices of right action, right speech, and right livelihood, making sure that all our actions and words and the way we earn a living is pure and upright, blameless. And then there are the concentration practices of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, the meditation practices, abandoning the hindrances, clearing the mind from all those mental obstructions that keep us from really settling into our meditation, having an object of mindfulness like the breath, and then establishing calm, undistracted concentration so that we can watch the mind, observe the body, and learn about it. So that's the Noble Eightfold Path, the eight practices that the Buddha encouraged us to do if we want to awaken, free ourselves from some of that discontent that's always bothering us, at least me. So in that Noble Eightfold Path, that second practice is right intention. The right intention, the Buddha said, consists of three intentions, three things that we should use to motivate every thought and action and word, that motivate every word, act, and thought. And make sure that the purpose behind those jibes with our core values. And those three right intentions basically are meant to become sort of core values that give our lives purpose and direction. Right intention, the Pali word for that is sammasankappa. And it's been translated in various ways. And I think it's useful to look at the various translations of that original Pali word, because it gives us sort of a three-dimensional look at what right intention, or that second factor of the path, really is. It's been translated as right intention, right motivation, right purpose, right aspiration, right resolve, and right thought. And by thought, I mean the thought that motivates action. The will or the desire to do something, and the motivation behind it. The practice of that second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention, is basically to commit to and develop those three wholesome intentions that the Buddha urged us to cultivate. Those three wholesome intentions are, of course, the intention of renunciation, as well as the intention of goodwill and harmlessness, or sometimes called compassion. We're supposed to cultivate those in the same way that we cultivate, for instance, goodwill or metta, which, you know, is not sort of a one-off thing. It's something that we we do again and again. And for many people, it's, you know, it's the bulk of their practice, cultivating metta. One very important message I'd like to convey today is this practice of right renunciation, the right intention of renunciation, should be approached in a similar way. It's not a one-off in that we say to ourselves, okay, I'm gonna make renunciation, and I'll explain in a bit what renunciation means. But it's not just saying, okay, I'm gonna make renunciation a motivating factor behind my life. So there, it has to be cultivated again and again on a on a regular basis, just as we cultivate and develop metta or loving kindness, so that it becomes second nature. It's not something we have to ever remind ourselves of. Oh, this is important in my life. It has to be. What's the expression used again? We have to think and ponder upon it, so that it becomes the inclination of the mind. Again and again, we have to think about it and contemplate why it's important, and remind ourselves that this is, something I'm going to base my life on. I think that's an extremely important point that's often forgotten when people talk about that right intention of renunciation. It's kind of assumed for metta and compassion that, we continually develop these, but not so much with renunciation for some reason. Another important point is, and I think it's been brought up in a couple of other talks, that word renunciation is a real turnoff for many people. And it can sound kind of puritanical, grim, and it can also sound like a big should. Even if I use the word today, it's unintentional. There are no shoulds here. I'm simply trying to convey what I've learned from the teachings, and by that I mean the original teachings and the suttas, about what renunciation, as originally envisioned by the Buddha, was meant to be, what he encouraged us to do with regards to renunciation if we want awakening and freedom from suffering. If that's not something you aspire to, then renunciation may play very little part in your practice, and that's just fine. But I think it's important to know what the what the ideal that the Buddha held up was, so that we know and we can decide if it's something we want to incorporate in our own practice, or maybe give it a try and see if we like the results. Or unless we have sort of a target or an ideal in mind, it's going to be hard to make those kinds of choices about our own practice. That sort of ideal renunciation as envisioned by the Buddha, originally envisioned by the Buddha, is often going to be difficult, a challenge in the life of a layperson, a householder, as it's often called, especially someone who's living and working in the world and has obligations to family and friends. It's certainly going to be a whole lot easier in a monastic setting or in a retreat center. And finally, one more thing to keep in mind during this talk, which I will begin, by the way, is that renunciation, the right intention of renunciation, is not all or nothing. I think Ajahn Chah's famous teaching has been used in one of these talks already, but I will paraphrase it again. A little bit of renunciation will bring a little bit of peace. A lot of renunciation will bring a lot of peace, and complete renunciation will bring complete peace. So it's not all or nothing. So, the right intention of renunciation, what in the world is it? First of all, that word renunciation is an English word, obviously not the word the Buddha used, but it's our best English approximation for the word that he used. I looked at the Oxford English Dictionary, of course, and it defines the word that renunciation comes from, renounce, as to reject or abandon a bad habit or way of life. And then it says, in the phrase to renounce the world, it means to completely withdraw from society in order to lead a more spiritually fulfilling life. So to reject or abandon a bad habit or way of life, if you are renouncing the world, it basically means to live the holy life, away from the world. Now the word the Buddha did use, or at least its closest equivalent, is nekamma, Pali word, nekamma, not to be confused with kamma or karma, has nothing to do with that. And it literally means to go forth, as in leaving one's home, one's family, one's property, to go forth into the homeless life of a monk or a nun. So that renouncing the world meaning. That's the literal meaning. But in the suttas, the written record of the Buddha's discourses, his sermons, it's almost always used as an antonym, the opposite of the words sensuality and worldliness. When a young monk or nun goes forth, or when a layperson chooses to develop the right intention of renunciation, that bad habit or way of life that they're rejecting is the habit of pursuing and clinging to sensual or worldly enjoyments. Another way it's often put is the intention or the resolve to abandon one's desire for sensual pleasures or worldly enjoyments. There's a problem with terms. Again, all of this is, you know, English translations of teachings that were given in a very different language. So we run into various problems with semantics and the connotation or tone of some of these words. And one problem with words like worldliness or sensuality, gratification of sensual desire, is they sound like we're talking about people like Caligula and Hugh Hefner and the Kardashians. This doesn't apply to me. You know, sensuality, worldliness, gratification, sensual indulgence, these words don't apply to me. But it's extremely important, if we are going to really practice this right intention of renunciation, to realize that our lives are exactly the kinds of lives that the Buddha was talking about when he used these terms. And the reason for that is everything, remember, is from the perspective of this enlightened, rarefied being who was living a very different lifestyle than we. And I'll describe that lifestyle. One other thing to keep in mind before I do that is, well, there are a couple of situations where it sort of became clear, very clear, that we and our lifestyle is what the Buddha was pointing to when he was using those terms. The first is his very first sermon, when he talked about what he called the middle way, which is basically, you know, the practice. He called it the middle way because this lifestyle of practice that he was encouraging us to embrace lay between two what he called extreme lifestyles. The first was these extreme, harsh physical austerities that many of his contemporaries were undertaking, thinking that this was going to liberate them from suffering or whatever their goal was. He said, no, that's not beneficial. It simply degrades the person who undertakes such practices. It should not be pursued. The other extreme lifestyle that he urged his followers to avoid and not pursue was the pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures. And that extreme, again, is our lifestyle. He was pointing to our addiction to the pleasant feelings that we can get through the senses. Pleasant tastes, pleasant sounds, pleasant sights, all the beautiful things we surround ourselves with, all the amusements that we kind of take for granted, going to the movies, going to a restaurant, all of these basically are, you know, in search of those delightful, pleasant feelings that result from such activities. That's what he meant by the pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures. So that extreme is our lifestyle, and he urged his followers to avoid it, to search for happiness in other ways than through the pleasant feelings one can get through the senses. The second situation where it becomes very clear that he was talking about us was after his enlightenment, there was an initial hesitation to even try to teach this Dhamma, these truths that he had discovered under the Bodhi tree. And the reason he hesitated was because he wasn't sure we would even listen. Because he said, this generation, this people who were living on the planet at that time, delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, and rejoices in worldliness. Again, he was referring to us, people who he saw as squandering this precious human life in pleasure-seeking and amusement. He wanted to show them something higher, something far more satisfying and lasting and reliable. But he just wasn't sure that they were going to listen. Fortunately, he overcame that hesitation, according to legend, at the urging of a deva, Brahma, I believe, one of those higher. But there was that initial hesitation because of the lifestyle that we are clinging to. I said that from point of view of one like the Buddha, who was enlightened and living a very different lifestyle than ours would seem extreme. It would be appropriate to describe as the pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures. I'll try and describe what that lifestyle was by looking at the lifestyle he followed prior to his enlightenment, or the lifestyle that he encouraged his followers to pursue so that they too could become awakened. The Noble Eightfold Path, but maybe a more sort of practical formulation of that would be easier to understand in this context. And that alternative rendering of the Noble Eightfold Path was called the gradual training. And so that gradual training was the way of life he encouraged his followers to embrace. It too consisted of a set of practices which could be considered sort of a step-by-step approach to weaning oneself from craving, including the craving or desire for sensual pleasures. And so I'll just describe a few of those practices that are most clearly motivated by that resolve to abandon the desire for sensual pleasures. As I describe this, I'd like you to sort of keep in mind how, from the point of view of one who's following such a lifestyle with this degree of simplicity and austerity, our own lives must appear to be steeped in sensuality and worldliness. So the first practice is moral restraint. We're probably most familiar with the five precepts, but for monks who were following the gradual training, it was a whole lot more than just the five precepts, beginning with not just abstaining from sexual activity that could be harmful, but complete celibacy. It also included abstaining from not indulging in, as it's termed in the suttas, abstaining from eating more than once and after midday, not watching performances for amusement, such as shows, fairs, dancing, singing, music, etc. Not playing games and recreation, such as board games, ball games, guessing games. Abstaining from the use of luxurious furnishings, beddings, rugs, etc., such as high and large beds. Certainly our queen and king size beds would fit that bill. Comforters, sheets and pillowcases made of fine material. Bedding decorated with fine patterns, all of this a monk was supposed to abstain from, not indulge in. He was supposed to abstain from adorning and beautifying himself, not wearing anything but plain and functional clothing, not wearing accessories, not using perfume and cologne, scented powders, makeup, not even looking in mirrors, and was supposed to abstain from frivolous chatter for the purpose of amusement, such as talking of food and drink, clothes and accessories, home furnishings, cars and other vehicles, travel, crime, politics, world conflict. Try and abstain from that these days. Gossip about others and talk of family, relatives, etc. All of these a monk was supposed to abstain from if he wanted to follow the gradual training. The next practice, contentment with little. While abstaining from this long list of pleasures, amusements, and diversions, one trains the mind to become satisfied with only bare essentials in regard to food, shelter, clothing, and when necessary, medicine. One does not indulge in luxury, comfort, excess, or self-adornment, and one trains oneself to be content with this, not to feel deprived. The next practice, moderation in eating, a passage from the suttas that clearly describes what this was meant to mean, is: and how, friend, is one moderate in eating? Here, reflecting carefully, a monk takes food neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the support and maintenance of this body, ending the discomfort of hunger, and for assisting the holy life. In other words, when a monk or nun eats, they are to keep in mind the proper purpose of eating, which is not to delight in the pleasant tastes, smells, textures, and appearance, but simply to keep the body healthy and nourished. Again, just keep in mind, someone who's following this way of life, you know, how does ours appear in contrast? The final practice I'll talk about is sense restraint. We do not allow the attractive features of any person or object to trigger desire or craving in the mind. If we see something beautiful or desirable, or experience something pleasing through one of the other senses, we are simply mindful of the pleasant feeling that arises, meeting it with equanimity and detachment, but do not actively indulge the feeling or feed on it for pleasure. If everyone were to practice sense restraint, I don't think Kate Upton would have much of a career ahead of her. By contrast, can you see how even those of us who live modestly are still, relatively speaking, steeped in sensual pleasures? Can you understand how in the eyes of the Buddha and his Sangha of monks and nuns, we would seem to be pursuing sensual happiness and sensual pleasures? I know that I risk belaboring this point, but unless we see that the Buddha was pointing to us in our lives, our lifestyle, when he said, you know, that this generation is delighting in worldliness, taking delight in worldliness and rejoicing in worldliness, I think we risk neglecting this factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, this right intention of renunciation. We'll feel it's unnecessary in our own case, because he's not talking about me. You know, I live a very modest, frugal life. And if we neglect this factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, we're, by definition, not practicing the whole path. And again, if it's awakening and true freedom from discontent that you seek, and that's a big if, then the Buddha would say that you have to practice the whole path. If that's not your goal, then again, maybe just use this talk for information purposes only. The Buddha, in describing the middle way, was not saying that we should avoid all sensual pleasure. Just by being in this world and doing things like, you know, nourishing the body by eating, we are going to experience sensual pleasure, pleasant feelings through the senses. What he did encourage us to do was to not do anything simply for the sake of sensual pleasure. That's an important point. We cannot avoid pleasant feelings, but we can choose not to actively pursue pleasant feelings or sensual comfort or enjoyment. That's, you know, again, it sounds puritanical and grim. I'm not going to comment on that until, well, I strongly take that back, because I am going to comment on that. That's the whole next half of my talk. Because it sounds puritanical and grim only if that's all, only if you stop there. But the much more important point is that the Buddha's not saying, therefore there will be no pleasure in your life. He's saying, no, these are lower, common, from the point of view of the Buddha, degrading pleasures. We're better than that. We can aspire to much higher, far superior pleasures that the human mind is capable of experiencing. The one that comes to mind first is just the extraordinary bliss of deep states of concentration, of jhana, which I know many of you spent many months talking about in the book club. Once you've had those experiences, maybe on a jhana retreat or something, I think it's eye-opening, and it really changes your whole perspective on this teaching of renunciation. It's like, whoa! I mean, there are pleasures that I didn't even know the human mind was capable of experiencing. I mean, we've been deprived of those pleasures all our lives if we've never been taught how to achieve those states. And so the Buddha was saying, renunciation is not deprivation. It's searching for something much better. There are extraordinary rewards awaiting if you're willing to forego these lower sensual pleasures. Basically, the fruits of the spiritual life. Jhana is just one of them. There's the bliss and peace of mind that comes from living a blameless and pure and upright life. Those ethical practices, the virtue practices. There's the freedom and simplicity that comes from contentment practice. There, of course, is the final goal of awakening, where all discontent falls away, and there's a lasting, reliable happiness. So these, but well before that, sometimes seemingly distant goal of awakening, there are extremely beautiful and extraordinary pleasures that come from following the path. So renunciation should not be thought of as deprivation, but as Ajahn Jeff puts it, a wise trade, trading candy for gold, as he puts it. So let me try and debunk a couple of maybe some more misconceptions about renunciation. The first one, and the most important one, is renunciation should never be thought of as deprivation. The next one, or next two rather, is some, especially Western Buddhist teachers, will claim that since true renunciation is not giving up things, but is giving up our desire for these objects of sensual pleasure, we don't have to give up things. We can continue to enjoy our comforts and pleasant diversions as long as we are mindful while we're doing it, or as long as we're not attached to these things. I don't know how many times I've read that and heard that. Let me address the first of those claims, that we can continue basically to live the same lifestyle we're used to as long as we're mindful while we do these things. It begs the question, why bake a cake if you have no intention of enjoying it? Why indulge in a warm bath if not to delight in the pleasure of it? And why see the next Star Wars film if you're not going to thrill at the experience of losing yourself in the movie? Why buy flowers if you're not going to take pleasure in the sight of them? Why do any of these things unless you intend to enjoy them, to delight in them, to rejoice in them? But with regard to that, a monk and scholar, Henipola Gunaratana, known as Bhante Ji, in his book, 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness, makes the following statement. Be skeptical of anyone who says you can mindfully enjoy sensual pleasures. This is not the Buddha's way. The Buddha taught us to mindfully let go of sense pleasures, such as the feeling that comes from eating tasty food, and remain detached from them. Be skeptical of anyone who says you can mindfully enjoy sensual pleasures, if you intend to follow the Buddha's path. Again, big if. So he's pointing to the need to withdraw from such pleasures and enjoyments if we want real progress on the path. Yes, ultimately, the right intention of renunciation is the intention to abandon our desire for the objects of sensual pleasure. But a necessary step to getting there is that we withdraw from the objects themselves, which is why, you know, people go to monasteries and retreat centers. It just helps an awful lot to make, you know, rapid progress on the Buddha's path. Really deepens our practice. That second assertion, that we can continue to live the same lifestyle we've always enjoyed, as long as we're not attached to any of these things. Ajahn Amaro has something to say about that. He's the abbot of Amaravati Monastery in England, one of those monasteries that was founded by Ajahn Sumedho. He would have us look very carefully at what we claim not to be attached to. And he illustrates this with the following story of a Tibetan Rinpoche who was visiting the home of a wealthy student in California, a very wealthy student in California, apparently. He says, the student was making a point of saying, I enjoy having beautiful things around. I like having a house in this beautiful valley, and so on. But I'm really not attached to any of it. I enjoy it, but if it weren't here, I wouldn't mind. At that point, Rinpoche picked up a coffee pot and started to tilt it over a $35,000 Persian carpet. And with the coffee getting dangerously close to the spout, he asked, so, you're not attached? Are you really sure? So when we tell ourselves we're not really attached to the beautiful things in our homes, the daily comforts we're accustomed to, the delightful pleasures that we look forward to, we have to ask ourselves, are we really being honest with ourselves? Ajahn Amaro seems to be saying that when we claim we're not attached and yet hang on to these things and let them occupy a great deal of our time and attention, maybe there's an element of denial there. And maybe it's good to look a little more carefully. So, the bottom line here is that we need to practice what's called internal and external seclusion. Internal seclusion meaning abandoning the desire for these things and these pleasures. External seclusion meaning physical seclusion from the objects of sensual pleasure. Again, it's one of the reasons why monks go forth from the home life into the homeless life. It's why lay people go to monasteries and retreat centers to deepen their practice. That physical seclusion is extremely useful and really necessary, at least initially. to make real progress on the path. These places are basically stripped of our usual comforts and amusements, and so they help us withdraw, in a sense, from our addiction to these things, just as going to a rehab center helps an alcoholic or a drug addict withdraw from his addiction. It makes it possible to wean ourselves from such pleasures, basically by going cold turkey. The Buddha illustrates this need for both inner and external, or inner and outer physical seclusion from sense pleasures with a simile. He says, imagine a piece of wet, sappy wood immersed in water, and water is used again and again in the suttas to refer to sensual pleasure. It's a metaphor for sensual pleasure. He says, just as one who wants to set fire to that piece of wood would not only have to remove it from the water, but also dry out that piece of wood so that the sap and the damp in the wood is removed. In the same way, we need to have both physical and internal seclusion from sensual pleasures. We cannot hope to attain real progress without both, at least initially. So it's basically we can't have our cake and eat it too situation, I think. We cannot have our sensual pleasures and renunciation too. Sorry. Again, all of this has that big if. If you want to follow the whole path with that goal of awakening and liberation from suffering and discontent. You can see why, in my own case, this is a factor of the path that has been much neglected. I think I'm not alone. So again, it sounds grim if we just focus on what we're giving up. But I don't know if I need to emphasize this again. I have here emphasize. The Buddha never told lay people that they must give up these things. I've made that point enough, right? This is just renunciation as originally envisioned by the Buddha for those of his followers who wanted to devote their whole lives to this wonderful goal of awakening. I'm going to skip that too. How am I doing? So it's grim if you just focus on what you're giving up. But as we'll do next week, we're gonna be thinking and reflecting an awful lot on the rewards of giving up those things. By letting go of our desire for and clinging to the pleasures of the senses, we can achieve what the Buddha called the happiness and blessing of renunciation. These spiritual pleasures that come from following the path. So another way to look, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was sort of give you a number of definitions of the right intention of renunciation. And so another way to look at what the right intention of renunciation is developing the understanding and resolve to look for happiness not in sensual or worldly pleasures, but in the higher spiritual pleasures. It's one way of looking at, you know, what is the right intention of renunciation. It's that resolve, that commitment to turn away from sensual pleasures because I want these instead, these higher, superior pleasures. The right intention of renunciation can also be thought of as the resolve or the determination to undertake what the Buddha called the noble quest. We are very busily involved in what the Buddha called the ignoble quest, pursuing sensual happiness and fulfillment in the things of the world. These are the basically the primary driving forces in our lives, looking for that fulfillment in the things of the world. Success, relationships, the respect and esteem of others, the pleasure, sensual pleasures, what the Buddha called gain, you know, accumulating wealth or objects that we desire, what is often called the eight worldly conditions. We are trying to be on the right side of the eight worldly conditions. We want to maximize pleasure and gain and esteem and fame, and we want to minimize their opposites. That's what's driving our lives. At least I think most of us. And that approach to life, the Buddha called the ignoble quest. Because it's doomed to failure, he said. We can't control those eight worldly conditions. And pleasant feelings come and go. And the things of the world don't always align with our desires. They're largely beyond our control. So one who aspires to the noble quest resolves to end their preoccupation with outer circumstances, aspires for a more reliable and lasting happiness that doesn't rely on sensual pleasures or worldly conditions. And he does this by devoting himself to reshaping the mind, changing the habits of the mind. So this approach, this noble quest, was the subject of that piece that Jean sent us by Andrew Olensky. And it's also illustrated in perhaps the most famous simile in Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva, which is not in our tradition, but it's a wonderful piece of writing in the Mahayana tradition. And this particular simile goes as follows. To cover all the earth with leather, where could such amounts be found? But simply wrap some leather around your feet, and it's as if the whole earth had been covered. In other words, it's foolish to try to protect one's feet from sharp stones by trying to cover the whole earth with leather. In the same way, we can never protect ourselves from all of the vagaries of the world by trying to get things out there just right, by trying to manipulate our outer circumstances, making the world as we would have it be. It's just an impossible task. And we will never have enough pleasure or objects of pleasure to satisfy the wanting mind. It just cannot be done. But it is possible to find ease and comfort by simply covering one's feet or simply changing the habits of the mind. So, a life devoted to such inner development was what the Buddha called the Noble Quest. You might think of it as just a doable quest. So here's one final way to look at the practice of the right intention of renunciation. It is the wise resolve to give up preoccupation with sensual pleasures and things of the world and make inner development the primary driving force in our lives. It is the wise resolve to abandon the ignoble quest and undertake the noble quest. So I hope that makes that practice of the right intention of renunciation a little clearer. Actually got a little time just to quickly summarize some of the main points if that seems useful. Any nays? So the right intention of renunciation is also known as the right motivation or aspiration or the right resolve of renunciation. It is basically to aspire to letting go of attachment to pleasant feelings that we can experience through the five senses, abandoning that desire for sensual pleasures. It's the resolve to stop seeking happiness and fulfillment in gratifying our desire for sensual pleasures and the things of the world. This lifestyle of sensuality and worldliness is not something that only real hedonists and materialists need worry about. But it's a practice for all of us who continue to look for happiness in pleasures and comforts of that can be gotten through the senses and the things of the world. It's not just living as we have always lived, but being mindful while we do it. Being mindful is a wonderful practice, and it's part of the path, but if we are going to aspire to this intention or this motivation to really embrace renunciation, then we have to, at least initially, change the way we live. We cannot continue with the status quo and just be mindful while we're enjoying all the usual comforts and pleasures that we're accustomed to. This practice of renunciation should never be thought of as deprivation or self-denial, but as a wise trade. Trading the Buddha did recognize the sweetness of sensual pleasures. He did acknowledge that there was a sweetness there. But he emphasized it's short-lived, it's unreliable, and there are many dangers associated with the desire for sensual pleasures. And he urged us to contemplate those dangers and shortcomings of sensual pleasures, and then contemplate and frequently reflect on the rewards and blessings of renunciation. So he said, as Ajahn Jeff puts it, it's essentially we're making a wise trade of these lower pleasures that have many shortcomings and dangers for these higher, superior spiritual pleasures that are more reliable and long-lasting. It is the wise result, the right intention, the right motivation, purpose, aspiration for renunciation is the wise resolve to abandon the ignoble quest and undertake the noble quest, making inner development, spiritual practice, the primary driving force in our lives, essentially covering our feet with leather rather than trying to cover the whole earth with leather. And finally, at the risk of repeating myself too often, it is not a commandment. It's an approach to living that is there if you want it, if you aspire to following the Buddhist path in its entirety, with the goal of full awakening and freedom from discontent. So that's today's talk. Again, next week, I'm going to follow this up with, first of all, the opportunity for a whole lot of small group discussion. I apologize for not giving people the opportunity for that today. And I'm going to sort of guide us through some of the reflections and contemplations that the Buddha encouraged us to do in order to cultivate this intention, in order to, using the sutta that Jean shared with us in her talk, the Tapusa Sutta, in order to help us, in order to help our hearts leap up at the thought of renunciation, our minds launch out onto renunciation, not just sort of going through the motions grudgingly because it's what I should do, you know. So it's that's just like with metta, something that we need to systematically and regularly develop through contemplating the dangers and shortcomings of sensual pleasures and our desire for those pleasures, and then contemplating the rewards and blessings of the alternative, the spiritual life. Okay. Thank you very much.